It's Monday, February 8th, and we could really use a defensive stand against coronavirus. We start here. In 2 weeks, the number of infections has plunged by 30%, but can it last?
That is likely the name of the game when you talk about the future of vaccines against SARS-CoV-2, is variant, variant, variant.
From Central Florida to South Africa, did this weekend just kick off another surge? At what point are you too rich for a relief check?
The higher up you go, the less effective it is.
Democrats could have chosen whatever numbers they wanted, so why did they choose these ones? And when you take over a country during a pandemic, you can't really arrest all the medical workers.
There were doctors, nurses, and public servants refusing to work in any kind of government capacity.
The internet is back up and running in Myanmar as people on the ground walk us through a coup. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. In a pandemic that is 1 year old, it's easy to think of COVID-19 as this relentless onslaught, right? Just day after day after day, it's still spreading, it's always the same. But there are clear inflection points. A few weeks ago, after a slow, steady, horrifying build in deaths, we reached a new inflection point. Since then, the number of Americans reporting cases of COVID-19 has actually been decreasing drastically. But we've seen throughout this pandemic, American holidays have created the wrong kind of inflection points as people gather together. Well, guess what? Super Bowl Sunday is essentially an American holiday.
Fans lined up outside of bars in Tampa.
It's harder to kind of maintain social distance when there's so many people out.
What's complicated here, though, is there are two big differences between this weekend and, say, Thanksgiving.
This morning, the vaccine rollout slowly gaining momentum.
It's going to be a quick poke. Relax your shoulders, please.
CDC reporting more than 30 million Americans have received at least one dose, and about 2% of the country has received both shots.
This time, we have vaccines. The other difference, though, is that in many areas, the virus is actually more contagious. A gathering can become a super spreader event that much more easily. So while cases are going down today, what's next? ABC's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Jennifer Ashton, starts us off. Dr. Ashton, can we talk about the good news first? Because we are seeing cases go down, right? How significant is that?
Well, I think in this war, as a lot of people are referring to this pandemic, we have to take every little victory we can get and celebrate them.
I will turn it over to Dr. Walensky.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be back with you today. Let's start with a snapshot of the pandemic. The United States continues to see a decrease in COVID-19 cases since its peak on January 8th.
And so when you look at 7-day averages and the trends therein, it does appear that in a lot of parts of the country, we're stabilizing and or decreasing, especially in terms of hospitalization rates.
Similarly, the number of new hospital admissions reported on February 2nd, approximately 10,500, was down nearly 42% since the hospitalization peak of 18,000 reported on January 5th.
So absolutely, that is to be celebrated. Now, the question, why? Vaccines were about 7 weeks into the first doses that were administered on December 14th. Mm-hmm. So that's starting to play a role in some settings, but also all of our mitigation efforts. So I think we need to recognize that this is a multifactorial in terms of what goes into it, but the result doesn't matter. We'll take it. It's good news.
Right. Like you said, it's not like people just started wearing masks all of a sudden last week. It takes weeks for this to sometimes get the momentum going. But so then, people who are vaccinated, once they get their second dose, the vast, vast majority of them will stay vaccinated. That's great. I get nervous when I start hearing about the UK variant accelerating around this country. How likely is it that before a lot of people are vaccinated, these numbers do start creeping up once again?
Well, I think in terms of those variants, the infectious disease specialists, the epidemiologists, the public health officials that I'm in touch with on a regular basis say it's not a matter of if, but a matter of when we start seeing that UK variant as the dominant strain in this country.
As the days and the weeks go by, you see, as predicted, an increase in the prevalence of the UK variant, the B.1.1.7 in the United States.
The fact of the matter is, though, Brad, it's hard to tell what you're dealing with if you don't look for it.
We also reported that whole genome sequencing was being performed on 4 specimens containing a molecular clue to determine whether the B117 variant is here in the islands.
And we're not doing that genetic sequencing on enough specimens right now. We're trying to ramp that up, but right now we're testing less than 1% of all viral specimens.
And the results are in, and for the first time, we can confirm that this highly transmissible variant has been detected here in the islands.
We don't need to test every specimen to know what we're dealing with, but we do need to test more. And again, if it's not the UK variant, it'll be another variant. And that's the name of the game with this pandemic, is that this virus is always changing and we have to change with it.
Well, and you mentioned other variants, because at this point, we're now seeing reporting that there's a study that's going to be released today about the AstraZeneca vaccine, specifically a study about how well it works against the South African variant. Well, it seems like the South African government is thinking those are not going to be good numbers, because just last night they suspended distribution of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Is that essentially how we're going to be judging vaccines at this point, Dr. Jen? Not just on, you know, do they keep you out of the hospital with regular COVID, but do they work against these faster spreading variants?
Well, I think you have to remember that when you talk about the efficacy of these vaccines, different endpoints will produce different results.
Oxford's early data, not yet peer-reviewed, revealing a single vaccine dose was 76% effective at protecting against the virus for up to 3 months.
So when you talk about reducing the risk of hospitalizations or deaths, that's obviously a very critical endpoint. When you're talking about the risk of asymptomatic infection, that's another endpoint.
The study also suggesting that the vaccine can reduce the spread of COVID by as much as 67% after one dose.
The risk of transmission, that's another endpoint. The risk of severe disease. So,
based on all those different things.
Absolutely. And we have to remember scientific context here, Brad. The coronavirus is responsible for 10 to 30% of common colds seen worldwide. And you and I both know we've had more than one cold in our life. So, yes, that is likely the name of the game when you talk about the future of vaccines against SARS-CoV-2 is variant, variant, variant.
All right, Dr. Jennifer Ashton there. By the way, Dr. Jen's got a new book coming out, The New Normal, A Roadmap to Resilience in the Pandemic Era. That launches tomorrow. In the meantime, Dr. Jen, never a Monday morning quarterback. She's always looking ahead. Thanks, doctor.
Thanks, Brad.
The question last week was, if Democrats and Republicans are nowhere close to a compromise on a COVID relief deal, would Democrats just go it alone? Well, as the weekend began, we got our answer.
I'd like to be doing it with the support of Republicans. I've met with Republicans. There's some really fine people who want to get something done, but they're just not willing to go as far as I think we have to go.
Remember, in the House, if you've got the majority, you can pretty much push through whatever you want. In the Senate, you usually need 60 votes, except once a year when you approve a budget.
On this vote, the yeas are 50, the nays are 50, the Senate being equally divided. The vice president votes in the affirmative.
Well, it was early Friday morning when Vice President Kamala Harris broke a 50-50 tie to push through a budget bill that includes many of the measures President Biden had outlined in his $1.9 trillion plan. One of the key parts of that plan, of course, is giving Americans straight-up cash. So if the question last week was, would Democrats give out cash by themselves, the question this week is, will it work? Austin Goolsbee is an economist with the University of Chicago, friend of the podcast. Professor Goolsbee, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when Democrats were saying, if you vote for me, we're going to do what President Trump said. We're going to give you a $2,000 check immediately. Well, they did this alone. Like, they got no Republican input. They could have made this number whatever they wanted. $2,000, $10,000. The number they've arrived at seems to be $1,400. Is that enough of a stimulus to really make a dent in this problem here?
Well, I would be a little careful. That's one part of what's a pretty big bill. They got hundreds of billions that would be going to the unemployed, to vaccines, to schools to try to get them reopened, for testing, for food stamps, for child tax credit. You know, there's a whole bunch of things. And checks. If it was just checks of $1,400, I wouldn't be thinking that that alone would fix it. And I guess my only other, not to be a schoolmarm or something, but I don't think the word stimulus is the right way to think about this. This isn't like when we were doing the stimulus of 2009. That's kind of a conventional, hey, this is a recession. How much could we do as the government that would kind of jumpstart growth and get the thing going on its own?
Like, this is rescue. This is relief.
I think this is rescue. And I think the right way to evaluate that is not, does that jumpstart growth? It's, does it go to the right people? Mm. Does it go to the people where they're facing permanent damage because of this virus shock?
I continue to believe that targeted relief bills are the most effective way to support our country without driving up unnecessary spending.
All of a sudden, many of them have rediscovered fiscal restraint and the concern for the deficits.
I'm kind of open to, you know, there's a whole side debate going on of what should the income cutoff be for the checks that go to everyone. And you know, the higher up the income you go, is that not self-defeating, but is it not as effective? Yeah, I think it's not as effective. The higher up you go, the less effective it is.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was a key thing that, that senators were arguing about. And eventually they passed this amendment like 99-1 that said wealthy people shouldn't get these checks. But then the question is, what's wealthy, right? Because $60,000 is the current answer to that.
Right, but then who's wealthy? Of course. So look, we can debate that back and forth in the details. I think that the number one rule of economics during a virus is you got to stop the virus if you want to help the economics. So I like more spending on that stuff. But ultimately, we have learned many times before that a little redundancy, a little overlap is not bad, because any one program, especially if you try to ramp up five times more than has ever been spent in that program before, a lot of times things go wrong. So let's have food stamps. Right. Let's have money for vaccines. Let's send out checks to everybody. And let's do these others so that we can make sure that that people get it.
Look, so can I read between the lines here? Because it sounds like you're saying it would be better maybe for somebody making $75,000 living in San Francisco to still get a check, because like they still might be hurting.
Yeah, that's what I think so. You know, that's what it feels like to me. And though dusk may be long, there is a difference between day and night. You know, we could argue about at what moment is it dark outside, but I'm telling you, there's millions of people for whom this is a very dark moment, and we're trying to get some stuff to them.
Well, and so you kind of have this philosophical divide right now between Republicans who are saying it is possible to do too much. Like, you could have runaway spending. You could create inflation. And then you got Democrats like Joe Biden who have said there is a big concern about doing too little, that you could make this much worse by doing too little rather than doing too much. What else besides just checks to Americans do you have your eyes on that would make a difference one way or the other that you think is critical to actually regenerating economic activity here?
The problem facing the economy is almost exactly the same problem that it's been facing since last March. We've had the same problem for a year, which is the virus is crushing the economy, and we need to stop the virus, and we need to help everyone hold their breath until that's done.
And the new numbers here tonight, just 49,000 new jobs added last month.
Nearly 18 million Americans are now claiming some form of unemployment. And more than 50 million people, including one in four children, are going hungry.
The make or break items are, it's got to be relief payments to the people that are right on the margin, that are on the edge of permanent damage. Mm-hmm. And there's got to be enough money in there to stop the virus. Okay, so they aren't incidental. This stuff, like, should there be $140 billion that go to schools so that they can add ventilation, so that they can get all the stuff, so they can reopen and people go back to school? I think that's super important.
There's been many prominent school districts at odds with their teachers' unions and local governments.
They want to prioritize teachers over every other resident in our city.
And the problem is, we just don't have enough vaccine.
There's millions of workers that dropped out of the workforce, many of them because they don't have childcare and they can't take care. They have to take care of their kids. So if we can get schools reopened safely, then that opens the door to a bunch of come back on the economic side. So money for vaccine distribution, money for home testing, rapid testing at cheap or free for everybody, money to schools to reopen, all of that stuff. Let's pay a lot of attention to that part rather than fighting of should it go up to 75,000 or 85,000. I just kind of think that's the wrong margin to be fighting on.
All right, Professor Austin Goolsbee from the University of Chicago. Thanks so much.
Brad, great to talk to you again.
Next up on Start Here, the military swept in quietly. Well, it got loud this weekend. We go to Myanmar after the break.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been 1 week since people living near the capital of Myanmar looked out their windows and saw military vehicles rolling up to inform lawmakers that actually the army runs the country now.
An apparent military coup erased Myanmar's civilian government, the military declaring a state of emergency over suspect voter fraud claims.
1 week since those officers took the democratically elected leader of the country and hustled her away along with other lawmakers who had just won their elections. Well, over the last week, the people of Myanmar had been trying to answer the question, what do we do now? The internet has opened back up in Myanmar, which means we are able to take you there right now. We're joined by Laura Kay, an American who traveled to the country to work with a volunteer group. Laura, where are you right now? I don't know what you can tell me safely, but can you just help me kind of understand where you're speaking from?
I live in downtown Yangon, just a little bit outside of the city center, so pretty much in the thick of the action, but on a quiet enough street.
Hey, so can you kind of, because you were there as this was happening, can you just walk me back to the day that this coup begins? What does that look like up close as that's happening that morning?
Right. I try not to check my phone in bed, but it was a lot of early morning messaging when we first found out. It was around 5:30 in the morning that I woke up. We were all just communicating with each other, hearing that the internet was going to shut down, trying to share information, trying to figure out what's really happening. There's a lot of fake news going around. And I actually got a message from a friend who is studying in the U.S., getting his master's, but he's a Myanmar national. And he said, oh my God, it's happening, and sent a video that I did not understand. It was all in the Myanmar language. Turns out that was someone recording his wife, who was a member of parliament, getting detained.
No.
In Yangon, I didn't see anything, you know, outside on the street. It was kind of eerie because I knew that this was happening and I knew it was a huge deal and it was changing everything. And at the same time, when I looked outside, it looked the same.
This is a video filmed by a fitness instructor that inadvertently captured the moment of the military convoy arrived at the country's parliament complex to detain lawmakers.
There were huge lines outside of the ATMs because people want to pull out money. It's actually a pretty cash-based society.
Banks subsequently suspended services due to poor internet connections.
After that, once everyone had their groceries, it was a bit quieter than usual, actually, that first day.
Right. And so that's day one. It's starting. People are keeping their head down, I assume. Since then, like in the week that has followed, did you get the sense that people are upset? And if they are, how do they express that, I guess?
By day three or four before the weekend, it seemed pretty normal, other than at 8 p.m. every night, people started banging on pots and pans.
Some shouted, "Evil be gone." A traditional gesture to drive out evil or bad karma.
There weren't yet any major physical protests, so during the week, the main movement was online.
And on Wednesday, 70 hospitals and medical departments across Myanmar stopped work to protest against the coup.
There were doctors, nurses, and public servants refusing to work in any kind of government capacity. So they were still working at the emergency hospital, they were still working in community spaces, but they would no longer work for the government. So people were resigning or refusing to work for this military that had taken over. So over the weekend, on Saturday, I went to the first major protest, which was on Insane Road, and it was a group of people who started marching in the morning, calling out chants. And they came down to this juncture where the police stopped them, and there were hundreds of police officers. The protesters were going up to the police officers and putting roses at their feet, red roses, because red is the color of NLD, and it's a color that's really come to symbolize this movement. And the police officers didn't become violent. They just stood there quite stoically.
We have a right to show our disagreement that we're against the dictatorships to prevent inequality, oppressions, in accordance with the democracy.
Their argument was not with the police officers. Their argument is not with their neighbors who just happen to be serving as police, because in a way, their rights have also been infringed upon.
It's the biggest protest in Myanmar for more than a decade, with rallies held in more than a dozen cities across the country. Crowds chanted, "We don't want a military dictatorship, we want democracy."
And I don't know how well you can speak for anyone else who's there, because I know you're a volunteer. Witnessing a coup is probably not on the agenda when you went to Myanmar, but you obviously care about the country, you care about people there. Do you get a sense of what this has been like for the average citizen of Myanmar who was part of this, I guess, kind of recent experiment, this fragile democracy, and what it's been like to see that go away over the last week?
Yeah, it's devastating. Honestly, I've had a lot of conversations with local friends. They're disappointed that this opportunity has been stripped away from them after the country has spent the better part of 70 years under military rule, enforced military rule. Mm-hmm. And this is after being occupied and owned by other countries in the past. So this really, in modern times, felt like the first chance to move away from that oppression. I mean, I heard, on Sunday from someone at the protest, they can't sleep at night. He said, "No one can sleep, no one can eat. We can't think about anything else because our basic rights have been taken away from us. And all we can do is just make it very clear that we do not agree with what's happening here and ask the world to listen." Members of parliament, the NLD members, actually held a session anyway. They're all enclosed in a certain housing unit in Naypyidaw, the capital, and they held a session and they made very clear calls to the international community to essentially not recognize this military government, to impose very targeted sanctions against military businesses, because the military has a lot of business here and they are making a lot of money. And that's really all that people are asking here. Just share the information and support them in what they're asking for, which is just the right to democracy.
All right, that is Laura Kay there in Myanmar. Laura, thank you so much for checking in and sharing your story.
Thank you, Brad. Thank you so much.
And one last thing. He was too old, he was too set in his ways, his success was too wrapped up in his old coach, and yet last night, Tom Brady managed to become the only player in history to win his 7th Super Bowl. In fact, forget other players, 7 is more than any NFL team has in its entire history.
One more snap, would you have guessed when this impossible season was trying to launch that you'd get it all in? You'd get to Tampa, and when the Super Bowl ended, the ball would be in the hands of Tom Brady.
I don't know why we ever think it won't.
Remember, the New England Patriots decided they were better off without a 43-year-old leader gobbling up millions in a risky multi-year contract, so they let him go. Brady instead landed with a franchise that has won a single Super Bowl 18 years ago. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers are like the opposite of a dynasty. And yet last night, the New England Patriots were sitting at home watching after a losing season, and it was Tom Brady leading the Bucs in the Super Bowl. Boston sports writers have called it the dumbest move since letting Babe Ruth go.
Patrick Mahomes is the new Tom Brady. He's the guy you don't bet against.
Patrick Mahomes is hard to go against that kid right now.
How can you pick against Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs? I mean, he just doesn't lose.
And yet, as the game began, even CBS commentators were predicting the Bucs would lose. I mean, come on. Could Brady really beat the most exciting young QB in the game? Well, Brady came out and dominated.
Here's Brady's pass. It's Gronkowski. Back again.
Third option.
End zone. Caught. Gronkowski again with the touchdown.
And forget about one slightly boring game. This throws an entire era into question. For years, football fans had always said the most dominant combo in football was Tom Brady and his coach Bill Belichick. You couldn't really say one was more important than the other, and because of that, it's even tough to decide whether either is the best at his job in history. But Belichick has never won a ring without Tom Brady. Tom Brady has now won one without any of his old friends, except tight end and professional bro Rob Gronkowski.
And there's more to come, right, Tom? There's more to come as far as football.
Yeah, we're coming back.
We're coming back.
You already know that.
Coming back. Tom Brady's coming back.
So if you were wondering who would go down in history as the best quarterback of all time, well, last night might have cemented it. By the way, not sure if you saw the kind of streaker-ish dude running on the field at the end of the game. Someone was pointing out, like, if you're a regular fan, grow up. Don't be that guy. If you're a healthcare worker, though, you know what? Like, maybe go for it. You deserve it. It's kind of been a year. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.